Hello, my name's Paul Coulter. I'm a medical doctor and a theologian. I'm head of ministry operations with an organization called Living Leadership and executive director of the Center for Christianity and Society, which is seeking to engage the culture with the gospel in Ireland. And it's my pleasure today to be interviewing Dr. Eric Johnson. Eric, would you tell us a little bit about yourself and what led you to be interested in the subject that we're talking about today?
Yeah, so I'm a faculty member at Houston Baptist University and something called the Gideon Institute of Christian Psychology. And at this stage of my career, my title is Professor of Christian Psychology. So part of my interest is to help to develop a Christian approach to the whole field of psychology insofar as a Christian worldview makes a difference. And while, you know, Christians and other folks are going to agree on a lot of things in terms of observation and measurement, at the heart of psychology are a set of assumptions that really affect how we interpret human beings and what our goals are in life. And so in the area of sex and gender, there's a lot at stake, and there's a significant difference between a Christian worldview and a mainstream secular worldview.
You've mentioned the word worldview a number of times there, Eric, and I'm very intrigued by this. I understand that when you approach this issue, you would say it's really vital that we go to the level of worldview. Could you tell us a little bit about why you think that's so important?
Yeah, worldview is an implicit set of assumptions that really guide the way that all adults think and approach their life. There's a set of assumptions about reality and about morality, why human beings are here, the right kind of ethical way of life, what's a fulfilling life. And all of those kinds of questions bear on sex and gender. One qualification is you know, academics talk about worldview. We're fascinated in it. We're aware of it. But we also have to qualify it in the sense that because it's implicit, most people aren't even aware that they have a set of assumptions. And one of the important tasks of Christians is to help raise awareness about this, because worldview is shaping the human sciences, lots of the academic disciplines, and it's really important that we help not just Christians, but non-Christian academics and thoughtful intellectuals become more aware of how their own worldview is really affecting the way that they approach topics. And in the process, unwittingly, they are prejudiced and biased against folks who hold other worldviews, a lot of times not even being aware of it.
Again, it's fascinating to me that you say that. I have done some thinking and writing around the question of worldview in the practice of medicine and healthcare. And I know in that whole field, in medical education, for example, it really is not touched on. So there are assumptions that are made, for example, that it's good to help people, but why is it good? What is a person? Those questions are not really dealt with. Is that similar in your field of psychology? Surely I would have thought psychologists would be asking those questions all the time, but...
Yeah, the difficulty is that the assumptions of materialism that dominate probably medicine as much as it does psychology are so influential. They're the atmosphere that psychologists are breathing in graduate school as they get trained into the discipline, and then they reproduce those assumptions in their own teaching. So I'm afraid they very much are at the base of the field of psychology. And with materialism, it's like there's an agreement that everybody should basically draw the same kinds of conclusions about reality, because we all value observation and measurement. And there's not much of an appreciation in the field of psychology that there's a whole bunch of other related issues that materialism completely ignores. For example, the realm of values and ethics. They typically, such topics get reduced down to the level of materialist assumptions, grounded usually in evolutionary theory and genetics and so on. And beyond that, they kind of feel any other discussion about things like values and ethics and spirituality are completely irrelevant. And it's just a given. So it's kind of controversial to raise these topics in the field of psychology.
So mentioning the idea of a materialistic worldview, I guess a lot of people use that word materialism, meaning just a love for money and possessions, but you're using it in a deeper way as a worldview. So could you just tease that out for us, maybe even by distinguishing that from what a Christian worldview might be, a secular materialistic worldview and a Christian worldview? What are the key differences?
Yeah, so you know, there's a number of terms that I think are kind of interchangeable. Materialism, naturalism, secularism would be, and humanism are sort of overlapping, but they all have nuances. And if we had more time, we could go into them. But the fundamental agreement is that there's nothing true or real beyond the material universe. So, reality is nothing more than material entities and processes. And to make reference to anything else besides for that is considered to be opinion based in sort of maybe religious assumptions that are not taken seriously in the sciences, because the sciences stick to what we can be certain about is kind of the assumption. And the way that things have gone over the last 200 or 300 years, the sciences have concluded that we can only be certain about that which we can observe carefully and measure. Everything else then is irrelevant to the search for truth, and that's a big part of the problem, because values and ethics are from a Christian worldview, we believe that there's truth in those subjects, and though not everybody agrees with them, and therefore we can't make the assumption that we're all on the same page about those things, that doesn't mean that there isn't a truth, and that therefore we need to talk about these things in order to at least raise issues that we're not all in fundamental agreement that we should stick to only referring to material entities and processes.
So from a Christian perspective, a Christian worldview obviously is not anti-material, presumably, but it's more than.
Thank you for, leading us there. So a Christian worldview, of course, begins with God and recognizes that he's the creator, the origin of the universe and of human beings. I like to bring in a Christian meta-narrative as kind of a framework for a Christian worldview. So we begin with creation, that we live dependent upon the eternal God, and he created human beings in his image. We're created good. However, we are in a condition of fallenness, of alienation from God, and that affects human life down here in multitude of ways. It blinds us to certain realities and affects the way we live and value things in human life. And then that would be the fall. And then redemption is that God has kind of committed himself to bringing human beings back into a way of life in communion with him, in fellowship with him, that restores us more to his original design plan for well-functioning human life. But even more than that, more wonderful than that, is that we're in a close personal communion with him in Christ, in union with Christ, that it appears to quite wonderfully exceed what our original parents experienced at the creation. So there's more to it, of course, than that. But that nicely summarizes some of the main features of a Christian worldview that is considerably different than materialism. In a way, materialism is fairly simplistic in terms of there's just so much that it leaves out of what is, from a Christian standpoint, very important about our place in the universe.
I can begin to see, even just listening to that, Eric, how as a psychologist, you know, if you believe in the fall and the effect that sin has had on people's thinking and our environment, as well as our own choices and so on, then that must mean that our experience of thinking and of feeling as we experience it can't be a reliable guide to what is right or good.
Yes.
I suppose that must have a bearing on these questions of gender and sex and sexuality.
Very much.
As well as maybe other aspects of that Christian worldview. So how would you, maybe you've given us that narrative, that meta-narrative approach, how would you walk through that with regards to gender and
so let's kind of jump into sex and gender. We begin with a good creation. So we Christians are fundamentally optimistic people. At least our worldview is, and part of our calling is to get in line with God's revelation about how wonderful the human creation is. So sex and gender was created by God as good. Part of apparently being in the image of God is that male and female are created good in the image of God. And we start there. So we want to take that seriously. And we were made for healthy relationships with one another. However, the fall has compromised our understanding and our practice of sex and gender. That's clear in Genesis 3, where one of the clearest teachings about the fall is that it distorted gender relations. The male is in a distorted way said to rule over. I consider that an example of patriarchy. Patriarchy is not God's design for us. There's a beautiful complement built into the created order and reinforced and clarified wonderfully in the New Testament. But men are not to rule over women. That's contrary to God's agenda. But that shows, I mean, the fact that men have been abusive over women in many ways, not universally, but in many ways over the centuries, is a sign of the fall. And Christians have no stake in defending that mistreatment, but rather revisioning the way God intended males and females to relate to one another, particularly in the beauty of marriage. There has been a distortion, a disorderedness that has come upon human beings, we might say, affecting our thoughts, our affections, our understanding of ourselves in the areas of sex and gender. And part of God's agenda in redemption is to bring healing into that, insofar as that's possible in this created life and completely in the age to come. So that I think kind of gives us a bit of a start in that area. I think one thing I want to clarify, and I'd like to talk about a little bit more, is that because of creation, I don't think that Christians would want to say that our understanding of sex and gender is completely disordered, natively, we might say, naturally, because God has written His law upon the human heart, and there are, particularly up until recently, there's pretty much a universal consensus across culture over history that men and women were different in good and noble ways, and those differences were to be respected in terms of our sexual activity, and that the norm throughout human history and across cultures has been that our biological sex in terms of the form of our bodies was normative for our sense of who I am as a male or a female. There was to be congruence in sex and gender that up until recently was the norm. So what we find then is that the disorderedness of the fall can change over time, can affect a culture as it has done in Western culture relatively recently, so that there's been a revolution in these areas over the last few decades. and has led to a massive shift in the way that we interpret gender, to the point which, strangely, people are extremely dogmatic about what is a relatively recent new set of assumptions about these matters.
I mean, I find, again, that interesting, Eric, from a medical and biological perspective. You know, it's very clear to me that there are two types of sex chromosomes, there are two types of sex cells in the human body, two types of organs that produce gametes, as we call them, sperm and eggs. And although there may be issues that affect some people that mean that doesn't function as it would in a normal, healthy body, it's very clear that there are two normals, and what you're saying is that would be part of God's design in the physical nature of things, the biological nature, but you're suggesting there's also an element of our psychology or of our sense of identity, at least, that should be congruent with that. And that seems logical to me, it seems sensible to me, but I'm thinking of that more from the medical and biological perspective. Yeah. How do you see that from a psychological perspective?
Yeah, so there's a host of complexities with these issues. And it's one of the reasons why I think Christians have been confused about how to deal with that. And I think we want to be really careful about how we talk about these things so that we do so as knowledgeably as we can and not speak out of sort of a knee-jerk reaction that has more, betrays a sort of ignorance of these complexities. Excited that we're having this kind of a conversation, because we need to talk more and more about it within the church and then learn how to carry on these conversations with a materialistic worldview community that does not share our fundamental assumptions. But I really believe that there are fair-minded people out there that recognize and share some of our sense that there's something crazy going on in our culture and are would be open to conversations with people who take the biology seriously. Where psychology comes, and I think sociology and cultural anthropology is also an important part of it, is we recognize what cultures do with sex is variable to some degree. And I would argue that that's built into the way God constituted us. There is a beauty. Most cultures honor the difference between male and female in terms of dress and certain lifestyle practices and values and so on. And that's a part of, I think, the richness of God's creation, to see different cultural expressions of that. But they're grounded in things like chromosomes, the fact that women carry the conceived child for 9 months, develop a special kind of attachment to that child during that time, breastfeed the child. Most women breastfeed their children for a time. That intensifies that closeness, that bond, that is a part of the biology that has shaped the differences that are universal, those differences that are universal across culture.
Again, that's fascinating. I would even add to that as well. There's that nurture in the womb. There's that breastfeeding. Also, at a genetic level, the mitochondria in our cells, which are the powerhouses of the cells, come only from your mother, because they come in the egg cell, not from the male contribution. And you know, I've often said that to people who find it incredibly helpful to realize that their mum, who may now be deceased, is still the one who provided life and nurture and gives you the potential for nurture throughout your life, even when you're eating food. That's powered by that. The power that gets into your cells is from a gift from your mum. And that seems to be a really good thing. And it's so sad, I think, when I hear people talking about those aspects of female biology as if they are only bad, destructive, or interruptions to something else. Maybe I can almost say, as a man and a father, I'm maybe just even a little bit jealous of those things. But
compared to the contribution of women in this process, men have very little that we add to this this process. And there is a way in which men can misuse that and mistreat women, but you're right. There's a glory, there's a beauty there that I think we want to honor and respect.
You know, it seems to me, Eric, that the impression that many people have when Christians speak on these issues of gender or sex is that it's oppressive, mm-hmm. destructive, that Christians are the bad guys who are, you know, just out to be oppressive and force ideas on people that are restrictive for mm-hmm. them, maybe maintaining patriarchy, whatever it might be. So, but yet the way you talk about this is there can be good news from a Christian perspective when it comes mm-hmm. to sex and gender. Could you tease that out for us a bit as to how you see the Christian worldview as good news?
Yes.
And then maybe why does it sometimes seem to people like bad news?
Yeah. Well, let me begin by another piece that I think the Christian community has not always done a good job talking about, because we've been, as is typical in the Christian community, we've emphasized the importance of the objective part of creation that has to do with biology and an honoring of that has been, you know, sort of a cultural universal until recently. The other side of the Christian view of things is that actually Christianity takes pretty seriously subjectivity too. We don't despise our experience, human experience. It's very important to God. God is a God who fully experiences himself in Trinity and in the creation. He's engaged. He's present, omnipresent throughout the universe and in human life. He knows the hairs on our head. There is a subjectivity to God that some Christian philosophers have spent some time reflecting on, and there's a valuing of human subjectivity that we want to honor and respect.
I mean, two things strike me on that. The incarnation of the Lord Jesus,
who
experienced that fullness of humanity, but also the indwelling of the Holy Spirit of God in believers is an intimacy and in a subjective sense. It even talks about don't grieve the Spirit of God. He can be grieved when we're acting in a way that is
yes, those are great examples. Thank you for that. Right there, you know, in the incarnation of the Son of God, as well as the close relationship that we have, there's a deep sense in which subjectivity is intrinsic to those realities. So we relish subjectivity. The challenge is that we also have to do justice from a Christian standpoint to the disorderedness of subjectivity. And that is precisely where we find problems in human life. Because while we do have aspects of our subjectivity that are ordained by God, that are a part of the law of God written in our hearts, when we're empathic with one another and we're sitting with someone who's suffering, we as Christians want to take that seriously and weep with those that weep, as well as rejoice with those that rejoice. That's a part of love in the Christian scheme of things. At the same time, we want to be prone to recognize when our subjectivity can be disordered, and because it can be disordered, we need help from revelation like the Bible in order to guide our interpretation, because what we find in the human heart is that there are some of our desires are part of God's created good nature that he built into us, and part of our desires and feelings are disordered, and they're a function of our alienation from God and the way things have gone wrong. Part of it even wrong objectively, in the sense that our gonads don't always function the way they are supposed to. Sometimes the processing of our sense of gender, our sense of sexual orientation can be damaged in utero or as a result of growing up in a fallen world and being mistreated by father, mother, and sexual abuse. All of these things can contribute then to a disorderedness of our desires. And so we enter into adolescence and we find, I have desires that are contrary to a part of me that says I should be attracted to the opposite sex. It's the way most people are. I have a sense that's normal, but yet I don't find those desires in me. Which desire should I follow? So we need the help then of a objective scripture to guide us, as well as the counsel of others who are wise and in the Christian community to help us sort out which desires do I follow, which ought I not to follow.
That sounds quite different, Eric, to me than what I think I'm seeing in our wider culture, which is where people are encouraged to only look within themselves for those answers, not
yes.
to look externally to any authority. Maybe there's a big suspicion of
yes.
of authorities, but if I hear you correctly, you're saying that it is a good thing. It's both good for us and good in the ultimate sense to submit to God's authority, to learn from him that God has spoken, that he's revealed himself, and to listen to others who are wise and
yes.
can help us.
Yeah, and what you were alluding to is so important to help develop a kind of skepticism to the sort of massive cultural influence that we have in our day that is directing attention sort of only to the disordered side of that conflict that we have inside of us. So if you feel same-sex attracted, go with it. But people... Well, let me just share some of my own experience. I have some level of same-sex attraction. I found out about it in my teenage years. I'm mostly opposite-sex attracted, but I have some same-sex attraction. That's not uncommon, you know? And so it's really misguided for our culture to tell us only go with the sort of exotic, unusual desires that you have. And if you have any transgender feelings, go with that. Whereas what I think we find, if we're going to be really honest and kind of search what's going on there, is there's a conflict. There's something inside me that tells me I'm supposed to be ordered according to my body form, the form of my body, and then you know, as we get to understand, as we've gotten to understand things like chromosomes, which you didn't even know about 100 years, that even underscores more fully that every cell in my body is male or female. Now we need to do justice to those exceptional cases. Less than 3%, I understand, of folks who are born with three sex chromosomes instead of the norm of two. But even such important exceptions that we want to take seriously, we want to understand that development and honor that, those exceptions. But we have to, don't we have to also recognize that that means 97% or more have only two sex chromosomes, and that then is a kind of normativeness that the Bible points us to as guiding our sorting out this conflict that I find inside me.
And even at that cellular level, we can see how the normal process of reproduction normally leads to those two chromosomes, and something has gone wrong with that.
That's right.
Whenever there are three.
That's right.
But even in those cases,
Thank you.
Quite clear when someone is male or female genetically, because the presence or absence of the Y chromosome determines that. So yes, to make those exceptions into another norm would just run against what we actually see in biology. I'm intrigued, Eric. It seems to me one of the questions I asked was, why does it seem sometimes as if Christians are giving bad news to people? And I think what I've heard from you is that it's sometimes the way we communicate. We need to communicate with gentleness, with grace. And also, we can be too simplistic or too quick to jump to conclusions. I can imagine that if someone says, I'm gay, for example, they might mean that, like you, they sometimes experience same-sex attraction, or they might mean that they are fully committed to that as an identity. It could mean so many varied things. If I don't listen well, I'm going to miss what really we need to be talking about and what that person's story is. So as you approach Christians, because it's clear to me that it's not only non-believers who will struggle in some of these areas, committed Christians can. What would you say to someone who's a Christian who is struggling with either their sense of gender identity or their sense of sexuality? What would you advise?
Yeah, the gospel is the good news for human life, but it doesn't promise a cure for all the disorders that we experience down here, diabetes and cancer, gender dysphoria and same-sex attraction. To some degree, the evidence suggests that there is a biological side to how that gets influenced. And what ends up then, the good news is that we have a wonderful God who loves us, who cares for us, who wants to help us find our way in this fallen world and to follow his design plan, which the Bible suggests is the best way to flourish in life. It's not the only way people flourish, have found to flourish, but we believe it's the best way to flourish in sync with his design plan for the way gender and sex is to be ordered. But that doesn't mean it's going to be easy. And in the Christian community, I think we do need to do a better job of coming alongside folks who are suffering and who deal with these kinds of struggles. There is a deep sense in which everybody has some set of struggles. That's a part of our fallenness. But in the church, I think we can do a good job of understanding the brokenness of the human condition. Really, we can do better justice to it than a materialist universe, which gives really no hope. You are what your biology is. Yeah. We can say there is truth there, but there is the hope of living a fulfilled life for living life to its fullest, which in some sense often involves denying some of my desires in order to find fulfillment for those desires that are the best in life, following God, loving him, experiencing communion with him, living in fellowship with other believers who are in the same boat, and then reaching out to a world that is really disconnected from their creator. All of those things give us fulfillment in a way that would be lost without God, without Jesus.
And I suppose as a married man, I need to say, and it's true, isn't it, that my greatest fulfillment, my greatest intimacy, my greatest experience is that intimacy with God, that knowledge of him. That's true whether I'm married or single. I suppose sometimes we can talk about marriage and sex in a way that makes it sound like that's the ultimate thing.
Thank you for saying that.
But there is a deeper and greater thing for all of us.
That's right.
And that has an eternal dimension too, doesn't it, Eric? Do you want to? I mean, you've talked about help that we can know now. I suppose there's also hope that when the whole of the new creation is renewed,
yes,
that some of these struggles won't be there in the same way.
Yeah. I just want to piggyback on some of what you were saying so nicely, that I think the church can be a place where we honor the fact that not everybody will be married. There will be probably some people who are following the Lord. They believe that they're called to celibacy based on what they're experiencing, and they don't feel that their calling is to get married. And gee, in the church, we want to honor that. There is a good, strong tradition going back centuries that people can find great fulfillment in singlehood. Yeah, the Apostle Paul being such a great example. And we really want to help folks that have same-sex attraction realize you're so valuable. You're so useful
in
the kingdom
life.
Of God. There's nothing inferior about it, but it's a calling to realize under the sovereignty, under the lordship of our good God. But at the same time, for all of us, the fourth part of the Christian meta-narrative is the consummation in heaven, where we find in our union, ultimately, our relationship with God, a freedom then from suffering in this life, and a satisfaction that we have only an inkling of in this life. We have every reason to believe that heaven is better, can I say it, better than sex. I think we have every reason to believe heaven is that whatever pleasures there are in this life, they are transcended and fulfilled in our eternity with our great Creator. And nothing will be lost down here in terms of the struggles and the suffering. On the contrary, I think Paul says that our suffering down here is working for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. And we want to encourage all of us down here that things are going to be much better up in heaven.
Eric, thank you. I think you've brought to us a real message of both help in this life. It's not just wait until heaven and muddle through. There is real help from God and from his people, but also eternal hope that transforms, I suppose, our attitudes for all of us to sex and to gender. So I really appreciate your input to us,
thank you.
Thank you for everything that you've shared.
Thank you.